For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about it because he was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
John was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
So, Dick, welcome aboard, and you'll do great.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I'm honored to be asked by the President to join his administration.
The death of a political giant. The man who served both Bush presidents, the former Republican Vice President, Dick Cheney, has died at the age of 84. We'll get reaction from a former advisor who worked with him 20 years ago and hear about his relationship with the current administration. Then, we'll stay in the States and check in on the race for New York City mayor.
I look forward to representing those New Yorkers.
Socialism has never worked anywhere on the globe. Not Venezuela, not Cuba. It's not going to work in New York City.
And we'll turn back to the net zero dilemma facing the Liberal Party.
The Liberal Party must compete in our suburbs and in our cities, and we demonstrated even in a disappointing election result last time that we can do that, and it will require a policy which gets the balance right.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, you could do an entire podcast series on this first story, so we're going to try and cover just what we can with the time that we have. Our guest today is a former advisor to George W. Bush. He worked with Dick Cheney nearly 20 years ago. He's now a leading Republican spokesperson and supporter of Donald Trump. As you're about to hear, that somewhat puts him at odds with Dick Cheney. So let me give you a brief rundown of just who Dick Cheney was, and then you'll hear from Scott Jennings. Decades ago, Dick Cheney rose through the ranks of Washington. He worked as Chief of Staff, Defence Secretary, and just when everyone thought he'd left the camp, turning to the private sector, he came back. He was asked to work with his former boss's son, running as George W. Bush's Vice President.
I believe you're looking at the next Vice President of the United States.
When the governor first asked whether or not I would consider being a candidate, I respectfully declined. In the end, I learned how persuasive he can be.
The late 46th Vice President was the man who showed that the role could be more than just the president's symbolic sidekick. He shaped US foreign policy. He was the architect of the US War on Terror. He was one of the most vocal about the need to invade Iraq and disarm Saddam Hussein of non-existent weapons of mass destruction. He said even though the intel then turned out to be false, he'd still do the same today.
I don't think you can make a case that the world would be better off today if Saddam Hussein were still in power.
So no regrets about Iraq?
I think we made exactly the right decisions.
For his role in multiple Middle Eastern wars and invasions, defending the use of torture and the maintenance of Guantanamo Bay, he'd been labelled a war criminal by some, including Iraqis like Sinan Antoon, who left at the start of the first Gulf War. Here are his reflections on the BBC today.
He was played a major role in pushing for what has come to be called the Forever Wars. In a different world, Dick Cheney would definitely be a war criminal and would be standing trial.
But then there are others, especially in the United States, where he's seen as someone who did everything he could to protect the United States. And that protection extended in his later years to disavowing President Trump.
In our nation's 246-year history, there has never been an individual who is a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump.
And the president didn't take kindly to him either. So, as we're recording this on Wednesday morning, we're actually still yet to hear from Donald Trump about Dick Cheney. Some Republicans have paid tribute, but the current president of the United States has not. That's why Scott Jennings is such an interesting person to talk to. He's become one of the Republican Party's leading spokespeople. He's one of Donald Trump's greatest defenders on cable news. But 20 years ago, he worked for the Bush-Cheney White House. We invited him on, and here are the reflections that he shared with Sally Sara.
Well, it's a sad day, honestly. Vice President Cheney was a legend in the Republican Party. I actually worked for him in both of his campaigns for vice president. And then, of course, I served in the Bush-Cheney White House. So I was privileged to be able to have spent some time with him, both in the campaign setting and in the government setting. And he had a storied career and was a real legend. And his loss is being felt, I think, with great sadness across the party today.
When you look back on his political career, what would you observe were his greatest strengths and his greatest vulnerabilities?
Well, he was known as a real bureaucratic knife fighter. And by that, I mean in government, able to understand how government worked and maneuver inside of it in order to achieve outcomes. You know, he was the youngest White House chief of staff in history. When he got elected to Congress, he immediately rose up into the ranks of House Republican leadership. He, of course, then ascended to Secretary of Defense and then became the most powerful vice president in American history. I mean, all of that was really because of just what a student of how to work the system he really was. And so I think he was mostly known as, you know, one of the Republicans' best government operatives. Now, I served in both Bush-Cheney campaigns, and even though he wasn't known as a gregarious backslapper, you know, when it comes to political campaigning, he was very good in debates and very good rhetorically. I remember in 2004 in the debate against John Edwards, he just took John Edwards to the woodshed repeatedly during that debate and kind of reminded everyone, you know, who the adults were in the campaign. So, you know, I regarded him as, you know, sort of a legend of government, but I also had an up-close view of what he could do in a campaign, and you didn't want to discount those skills either.
The links between 9/11 and Iraq, Dick Cheney got those wrong publicly. How do you reflect on that?
Well, certainly one of the things he'll be most linked with in his biographies is the decisions that were made in the Bush White House after 9/11. And, that's a big part of his legacy, keeping America safe, engaging in foreign wars, you know, the muscular response to radical Islamic terrorism, the implementation of the Patriot Act. I mean, you know, you can go back in time and look at all of that. And certainly Vice President Cheney was in the middle of it. Of course, if you go back further, when he was Secretary of Defense, in our United States' first foray into Middle Eastern wars, the Persian Gulf War, he was obviously part of that too. So, you know, I think both President Bush and Vice President Cheney made the best decisions that they could make with the information they had and the circumstances in which they were given. And some of those decisions turned out to be very, very right. And some of those decisions obviously turned out to have been extremely polarizing and unpopular. And, you know, we'll be debating them for a very long time. I do think the thing about Bush and Cheney both at that time was that I think they both thought they were doing what was right to keep Americans safe. And, you know, there was not another terrorist attack on U.S. soil while they were in office.
But the consequences for many people in Iraq and the strategic consequences were very dire.
Sure. Those were consequential decisions. There's no question about it. You know, I'm not really going to go back in time and criticize Vice President Cheney here on the day that he's passed away about making decisions that or making advice to the president, I should say, about what he thought was best to keep America safe or in the best interest of American national security. But you're absolutely right. Americans have debated these matters for years. I think that era sort of led to a souring of the American people on military intervention around the world. I mean, we not only had the war in Iraq, but then we had the, you know, long lingering war in Afghanistan as well. And so I do think there's a little bit of fatigue from those decisions.
Scott, earlier you were alluding to the way in which Dick Cheney changed the role of vice president. It had been a ceremonial role, often in the hands of others. In what way do you think he changed the way the role was performed during his time?
Well, what's interesting about him is that he had no personal ambition at that point to become president. You know, most of the time, vice presidents are looked at as potential future presidents. Kamala Harris certainly was. I think J.D. Vance is today. I mean, that's common. But by the time George W. Bush picked Dick Cheney, I think he was past that point in his career. And so when you don't have your vice president serving in that role as a potential successor, it kind of, in my opinion, it sort of makes them really more into an advisor. And Cheney's years of Washington expertise, both having been in the House and having been Secretary of Defense and having been White House Chief of Staff, made him the most experienced advisor that George W. Bush could have possibly had.
Scott, just finally, in latter years, Dick Cheney was a very strident critic of Donald Trump. How was that received within Republican ranks?
He, like other Republicans from the old guard, departed from President Trump after January 6th. And he was certainly wasn't the only one, but he was one of the most high profile. And certainly his daughter, Liz Cheney, was perhaps the most prominent Republican critic of President Trump out there. Now, I think Vice President Cheney did support Donald Trump in 2016, even when some people weren't. And so, you know, he had a little bit of a roller coaster with Trump. But, you know, he's hardly unusual in that. But I don't think it overshadows his overall service to the country or his overall service in long history with the Republican Party. I'll certainly always remember him as a great vice president, a great Republican, you know, kind of a grandfatherly figure. I had a chance to brief him on numerous occasions when I worked for the Bush-Cheney team. And, you know, even though I'm a supporter of President Trump and he wasn't, that doesn't diminish his service to the country and the party in my eyes.
And you were just listening to Republican spokesperson Scott Jennings, a former advisor in the Bush-Cheney White House, discussing the life and legacy of the late American Vice President Dick Cheney. Well, let's leave American politics and turn to the issues of the day back here. The Liberal Party's internal debate over emissions and energy policy continues to play out in public and behind closed doors. Our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, joined Sally for an update on some of the comments from leader Susan Lee, because she said that she's confident she will still be the leader in the months ahead.
While the party is still agonising about its position on emissions reduction and energy policy, they're clearly very conscious that it is causing them political damage. They only need to look at recent polling to see that their low approval ratings continue to fall. So we've seen Susan Lee today do a round of media interviews, and she's speaking to colleagues as much as to the public in these media interviews. And she's reminding everyone that the process that they're going through is the one that she set out when she took on this leadership, which was to give each of the Liberal and National parties space to develop their own policies before then coming together to develop one. And she made that clear, that she was reminding everyone that what she's been doing is exactly what she said she would do. So it's been quite a defensive approach from Susan Lee this morning, as we heard on AM.
And I said, as leader, when I became leader, there wouldn't be any captain's calls. We'd take the time to work through policy. We would also articulate clear differences between ourselves and Labor. And I've done that with two important economic speeches.
Opposition leader Susan Lee there, speaking to the ABC's AM program. We'll leave Mel and bring in Sally's interview with the Shadow Finance Minister, Senator James Patterson, a Liberal frontbencher. Sally asked him what his position was on net zero.
As you remember from our previous discussion, Sally, as a member of the leadership group and the Shadow Cabinet, I'm not publicly canvassing my views on this because I've got plenty of opportunities to have my say internally. What I can say to your listeners, though, is that they will not have long to wait for the Liberal Party to articulate its own view on this. The National Party is an independent sovereign party and they have gone through their process. The Liberal Party is going through ours and we will determine what we think is in Australia's national interest.
You can't return to government unless you win seats in the urban areas, particularly of Sydney and Melbourne. What are you doing to ensure that your policies are aligned with the views of those voters?
It's self-evidently true that in the most urbanised democracy in the Western world, the Liberal Party must compete in our suburbs and in our cities. And we demonstrated, even in a disappointing election result last time, that we can do that. Tim Wilson won the inner city seat of Goldstein back from the Teals, and I'm confident we can win more seats like that, as well as our traditional strongholds, for example, in Melbourne, like Menzies and Aston and Chisholm and Deakin, and it will require a policy which gets the balance right. I think it will be important for the Liberal Party to demonstrate we are committed to emissions reduction, that Australia will do our fair share, but that we also won't ask Australians to do more than the rest of the world or go ahead of the rest of the world at the expense of our own economy or their electricity bills.
Do you agree with your colleague Andrew Bragg that while it would be good for the coalition to stay together, it shouldn't be at, quote, any cost?
Well, I mean, it's self-evidently a true statement that if the Liberal Party and National Party views are completely irreconcilable, then we couldn't be in coalition. But it is my very, very strong preference that we remain in coalition, because we cannot form government without being in coalition with the National Party.
We've heard from Susan Lee on AM this morning on ABC Radio. She's confident that she will remain leader of the party until the end of the year. Is that confidence warranted in your view?
Yes, it is, and I strongly support Susan's leadership. It is critical as a party that we resolve these big questions like net zero. But when we've done so, we will be able to then turn our fire on the government. And frankly, their energy policy has been relatively unexamined in recent times because we have been distracted. But focusing on that, I think, will demonstrate just how weak the government's energy policy is, how much harm it's doing to our country. And I think we can win a lot of support in the community after doing so.
How would the coalition bring down energy prices for businesses and consumers? We haven't heard that articulated clearly since the election.
No, you haven't, and that's because we're still resolving these big issues internally, and I don't want to mislead your listeners that we've been out there articulating that argument. We have to articulate that argument, and that's why resolving these issues is a prerequisite to having that debate with the government, and we will have a burden on us to demonstrate what our alternative policy vision is to bring electricity prices down.
And that's where we'll leave the Liberal frontbencher, Senator James Patterson. He was speaking there to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. There are countless Australian-made TV shows and films that are much loved by audiences right around the world. You only have to think of Bluey, and now you'll have that theme song stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Well, this week the federal government will introduce long-awaited legislation to force the popular streamers to help produce more Australian content. The rules could apply to streamers with more than a million Australian subscribers, so think Netflix, Disney+, Amazon Prime. It'll force them to spend a share of their local revenue on making Australian programs. We wanted to hear from the industry, so we invited on Matthew Diener, the CEO of Screen Producers Australia. He gave us some detail on the current state of production of locally made content.
Look, we've had over the last few years a drop from commercial television, and that's probably at the same time we've had local streaming services come in. They've done a bit when they first launched, but the international services have dropped over the last year, and we think the data that will come out this year will show that there's been quite a collapse in the amount of commissioning. So the industry's been in a bit of a crisis over the last 12 to 18 months. So the announcement that was made yesterday is really good news for the sector, because it shows progress and forward thinking from the government when this has been regulation we needed for a long time.
And the whole ecosystem has changed so much with streaming services coming in, and given the expense of particularly things like drama, the broadcast model doesn't support that kind of production as much as they once did.
No, it's very hard for producers, and I represent producers who are raising funds, running small businesses. It's very hard to raise that sort of money now for a drama series. So you've got a problem where the world is struggling to make these sort of series, but you know, there's still audiences for them. And you really need to look where the eyeballs have gone and where the money's gone. And that's gone from traditional media onto new platforms, including YouTube, but certainly the big streaming services like Netflix, Amazon, Disney+, Paramount+, they are where audiences have gone. And that's been quite disruptive for the traditional media landscape.
And if we're on the front foot here, this is not just about having local content for local audiences. If good content is produced, it'll travel. It will do well with an international audience.
That's right. So there's a challenge with those big brands, because there's a salience bias, right? Depending on what is in front of you, that is pretty what you will watch. But Australians love our stories. They love watching it when they're given the opportunity for well-made stories to be presented to them. And the rest of the world also loves them. We do really well with selling, and the audio clip from Bluey is a great example of I think the world's most, you know, downloaded or streamed show. But all of that is a challenge in an English language market like Australia, where we have to compete with the largest providers of audiovisual content in the United States and in the UK. So we've always needed levels of intervention in our market. market. Now, we've had that for a long time, and that supported the ecosystem, and that's been for commercial television, and it's also had resources for the national broadcasters to be able to ensure that Australians can see their stories and that we've had an industry built to be able to provide that to them. Now, we're about to find out the bill will be, I think the announcement is that the bill will be, you know, introduced tomorrow. From there, we'll understand what the pitfalls or otherwise in that legislation is, and we know that it won't solve every problem. We're dealing with the largest businesses globally who do not want regulation, and landing this is a very important milestone in the progress.
And that's Matthew Diener, the CEO of Screen Producers Australia, talking about those proposed rules to get streamers producing more Australian content. We're going to end overseas today because the polls are closing in New York for the race to be the city's next mayor. It's a showdown between the former Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, and 34-year-old Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist hoping to make history as the city's first Muslim mayor. Donald Trump isn't on the ballot, but he's been a dominant force in the race, endorsing Mr. Cuomo and threatening to cut federal funds if Mr. Mamdani wins. Now, by the time you're listening to this, if you're catching up a little later on, the results may be in. But here's a little bit of context about the vote and how Election Day has gone on the ground. We spoke with Ben Max, the host of the Max Politics podcast.
Well, here in New York City, Zohran Mamdani's candidacy and then some of the opposition against him is certainly drawing a lot of voters to the polls relative to what we've seen in prior general elections for mayor. Now, we hold our mayoral elections in these off years that are not the same as presidential years or even gubernatorial years. So take it all with a grain of salt, but we are seeing higher turnout than we've seen in past mayoral elections for at least the last several cycles. We've usually been getting about 1.1 million votes in the general election for mayor the last few cycles, and we're on pace at this moment for somewhere around 2 million votes in this election.
What do you think has really drawn people into engaging with this campaign?
Well, first and foremost, Zohran Mamdani has run on a platform focused on affordability. He's run a very charismatic and forward-looking campaign. He's brought a lot of energy and volunteers and a base with his supporters in the Democratic Socialists of America, New York City chapter. And then there's been the energy of some of the opposition, mostly behind former Governor Andrew Cuomo, but a lot of the energy for Cuomo is actually opposed to Mamdani's candidacy. And while some of that is about his Democratic Socialist policies, especially calls to increase taxes on high-income earners and corporations and spend it on a lot of expansive socioeconomic programs, there's also been the hot-button issues of Mamdani's strident criticism of the Israeli government over its war in Gaza and prior actions, and Cuomo's strident support for Israel in that war and broader government.
Ben, tell me about the Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa.
Curtis Sliwa was a longtime New York character. He ran for mayor 4 years ago and got beat resoundingly by the outgoing mayor, Eric Adams, by about 40 points or so. He founded a sort of pseudo-vigilante group called the Guardian Angels back when New York City had much higher crime levels, and they patrolled the subways and the streets and tried to prevent violence, but have never been particularly seen as that effective of a force. And he's really been a radio personality more than anything in terms of his professional career. So he's in the race, and he's certainly part of the reason that Mamdani looks like a heavy favorite, although anything could happen here with the surge of voting we're seeing. But Curtis Sliwa, the Republican nominee, is speaking to a lot of the diehard Republicans in New York City. But New York Democrats are out-registered to Republicans about 6-1 in the city, so it's a very heavily Democratic city.
So the question is, will they pick a Democratic nominee? Ben Max, host of the Max Politics podcast, speaking to us from New York City. And that is the Breakfast Wrap for today. Thank you for listening to every interview, presented by Sally Sara and produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. And you can hear all these sorts of interviews live every day from 5:30 a.m. We can catch The Breakfast Wrap later on, either on the ABC Listen app or also on Radio National.